On the morning of the 9th of October 2022, Jessica Brooks received an alarming phone call from her pregnant daughter's husband in New Boston, Texas. Concern filled his voice as he explained that he couldn't reach her and that their daughter had failed to appear at daycare. Jessica's heart raced as she hastily arrived at her daughter's home, only to be overcome with terror at the sight of blood staining the back door handle. New Boston is a small city nestled in East Texas with a population of less than 5,000. It carries a rich history dating back to its early settlement by W.J. Boston, an esteemed storekeeper. Located approximately 160 miles northeast of Dallas, the town saw the emergence of two more Bostons with the development of the railroad. One of these was New Boston, positioned about 4 miles north of the original settlement. It was within the confines of this close-knit community that 21-year-old Reagan Simmons Hancock resided. She was the firstborn to her parents and had a real strong bond with her mother, Jessica Brooks. Reflecting on her daughter's character, Jessica fondly recalled Reagan's unwavering love for those she trusted and her genuine desire to assist anybody in need. Describing her vibrant personality, Jessica emphasized Reagan's unique blend of resilience and tenderness, a spirit capable of standing her ground yet radiating warmth. Reagan was fiercely independent and a very strong woman. Her friend, Kelsey Conway, said of her, "I can say without a doubt her mother raised a good child." Despite any personal challenges she faced, Reagan maintained an optimistic outlook and possessed an uncanny ability to bring smiles to the faces of others. In 2017, Reagan embraced motherhood at the age of 18 when she welcomed her daughter, Kinley, into the world. Jessica couldn't contain her pride, expressing her admiration for the remarkable mother that Reagan had become. She had always known that Reagan's profound desire to be a mother would manifest into something extraordinary, and it certainly did. Reagan despised the derogatory remarks often aimed at young mothers, and she was determined to prove them wrong. Working tirelessly to provide for herself and her young daughter, especially in the absence of Kinley's biological father, Reagan found solace in the presence of another man in her life, Homer. Although not Kinley's biological father, Homer embraced her as if she were his own flesh and blood, and he was actively pursuing full-time custody. Then in early 2019, Homer proposed to Reagan, and she readily accepted. Eager to celebrate their engagement, Reagan sought the assistance of her friend, 27-year-old Taylor Parker, who also happened to be a photographer. Taylor frequently promoted her photography business on Facebook, offering maternity photo shoots that included a complimentary session at the hospital after delivery. At the photo shoot, the family posed together with Kinley wearing a t-shirt which read, "Mommy, will you marry my daddy?" Reagan posted the photograph on her Facebook along with the caption, "Love my little family." In the comments, Taylor replied, "My fave family." Then both Reagan and Homer replied to her, thanking her for taking such great pictures. On the 21st of September 2019, Reagan and Homer exchanged vows, with Taylor capturing the precious moments as their wedding photographer. The blossoming family settled into a home on Austin Street, working diligently to provide for their loved ones. Reagan secured employment at Flying Burger and Seafood in Texarkana, while Homer transitioned from a role as a jail guard to finding work at a landscaping company. Their joint efforts enabled Reagan to acquire a new source of pride: an impressive 2020 Nissan Rogue SUV. As their family expanded, the need for a larger vehicle became apparent. In early 2020, Reagan received news that she was expecting her second child. A subsequent sonogram revealed that the baby would be a girl. Coincidentally, Reagan's friend, Taylor Parker, also shared the news of her pregnancy, further deepening their bond as they embarked on their parallel journeys of motherhood. Reagan and Homer had already chosen a name for their soon-to-be-born daughter, Braxlyn. However, Reagan had a hunch that Braxlyn might appear in the world ahead of schedule. Sharing her concerns with her friend Abby Mathis, Reagan expressed her readiness for Braxlyn's arrival, but also admitted her apprehension about a potential early delivery. She confided, "I'm so ready for Brax to be here. I'm scared she's fixing to come faster. I feel like she's going to be here before November." Deeply rooted in her faith, Reagan held on to her beliefs and worried that Braxlyn might be born prematurely. One afternoon, seeking solace and support, she sought out her friend Abby to join her in prayer, requesting that Braxlyn remain safely nestled inside her womb for as long as possible. Their collective hope was that when time came for Braxlyn's arrival, she would be blessed with good health and vitality. Meanwhile, Homer made a significant career change, accepting a new job at a trucking center that offered him more flexible working hours. This decision not only provided financial stability for the family, but also allowed Homer to play a more active role in their lives during the impending arrival of Braxlyn. Life was good for the family, and they were eagerly awaiting the arrival of Braxlyn. It was shortly after 9:30 a.m. on the 9th of October 2020, when Texas State Trooper Lee Shavers pulled over a vehicle in DeKalb, which isn't too far away from the Oklahoma border, for speeding and driving erratically. Recounting the incident, he described the events leading up to the stop, stating, "A black 2009 Toyota Corolla, with its hazard lights on, was going west at a high rate of speed. It almost struck a truck, then the car crossed over the double yellow lines, then swerved back on the shoulder, and almost hit a man on a bicycle." As the car came to a halt at the side of the road, Trooper Shavers cautiously approached it. He noticed that the female driver was frantically waving her hand out of the window. It became apparent that she was engaged in a phone conversation with the emergency service, who she had informed that she had just given birth inside the car. Drawing closer, Trooper Shavers observed a newborn baby girl in the driver's lap, seemingly still attached to the mother by an umbilical cord that extended from her navel. The woman's distress escalated as she cried out that her baby was not breathing and that she needed immediate transportation to Isabel Hospital. Blood was visible on her face, forehead, shirt, and shoes. Fortunately, an off-duty nurse named Amanda Perkey happened upon the scene and promptly halted her vehicle to offer assistance. Amanda observed that the baby appeared to be clammy and cold, but clean. Recognizing the gravity of the situation, she initiated CPR on the infant, while awaiting the arrival of paramedic Elton Crossland. Upon Elton's arrival, he immediately noticed that the amniotic fluid present on the baby's skin was dry and flaky, a clear indication that the birth did not occur as recently as claimed by the woman. Additionally, the interior of the car lacked the telltale signs associated with a recent birth, such as blood or amniotic fluid. Elton recounted, "The birth of a baby is not a neat or clean process. There was no blood or amniotic fluid. It was obvious to us that the baby was not born in the car." Efforts were swiftly directed towards saving the baby's life. Elton attended to the infant, only to discover that she had no pulse. He administered intravenous fluids and continued CPR, even resorting to administering epinephrine, commonly known as adrenaline, in an effort to restore a pulse. The woman and the baby were then rushed to McCurtain Memorial Hospital in nearby Idabel, Oklahoma. Despite the dedicated efforts of the hospital's staff, the baby couldn't be revived, and she was pronounced dead upon arrival. Tragically, she had suffered extensive brain damage, due to a lack of oxygen. While the medical team attended to the distressed woman, nurses, including Carissa Bryan, commenced their examination to ensure proper uterine contraction and prevent excessive bleeding. However, during the assessment, Carissa noticed that the woman's uterus didn't feel like that of a recent postpartum patient. She recalled, "We had a mom, we had a baby, and a placenta. It didn't make sense." Further adding to the perplexity, the new mother showed no signs of active bleeding. The nurses called for an ultrasound, and when Dr. William Heron did a vaginal exam, he did not see a cervix, which indicated that the woman likely had no uterus. When the ultrasound confirmed that the woman had no uterus, Dr. Heron ordered a quantitative HCG test run on her blood. The so-called pregnancy hormone can show up for up to 6 weeks after delivery, but it came back as negative. While the woman was being examined in the hospital, another incident was unfolding in New Boston. At his workplace, Homer Simmons Hancock was becoming increasingly concerned as his attempts to contact Reagan, who was 35 weeks pregnant, were unfruitful. Concern escalated when he discovered that Kinley hadn't been dropped off at daycare that morning. Fearing the worst, Homer urgently contacted Reagan's mother, Jessica, and requested that she visit their home to check on them. Jessica, accompanied by her husband, Marcus Brooks, who had been a father figure to Reagan since her childhood, promptly arrived outside the family home. Jessica approached the back door, and her attention was immediately drawn to blood stains on the doorknob. Using her shirt as a makeshift barrier, she cautiously opened the door, revealing a chilling scene in the kitchen. The floor bore bloody footprints, while the countertops, appliances, and surroundings were splattered with blood. A trail of blood led from the kitchen into the living room, prompting Jessica and Marcus to follow it. In the living room, they found Reagan, lifeless and face down on the floor, her body drenched in blood that rendered her once blonde hair a dark shade of red. Jessica, overwhelmed by the gruesome scene, immediately recognized the severity of the situation. Recalling the tragic moment, she later stated, "I knew from all of the blood that she was gone." Collapsing to her hands and feet, she unleashed a deafening scream before dialing 911 for assistance. Marcus, who was grappling with the horrifying reality, worried about the whereabouts of Kinley and feared that she had met the same fate as Reagan. He called out Kinley's name in desperation, but was met with a chilling silence. However, after a tense moment, he could hear a muffled shout. Marcus traced the voice upstairs to Kinley's bedroom, where he discovered her lying on the bed. Wrapping her in a protective blanket, he carried her outside as they awaited the arrival of paramedics and law enforcement. Paramedics were quick to arrive on the scene, but they didn't enter because it was reported to not be a survivable incident, and they didn't want to disturb a potential crime scene. As it was discovered, Reagan had been stabbed more than 100 times, and her skull had been crushed with some kind of object. There was also a scalpel embedded in her neck, which had been slashed. As Detective Chard Ford took charge of the investigation, he immediately learned that Reagan had only been 5 weeks away from reaching full-term pregnancy. Seeking clarity on the potential viability of the unborn baby, Braxlin, Detective Ford requested the presence of a paramedic inside the residence. Carefully rolling Reagan onto her back, they made a grim discovery. A large incision spanning from hip to hip, and Braxlin was nowhere to be found. Once it was discovered that Braxlin was missing, Detective Ford issued alerts across the area. One of the paramedics on the scene, Jared Nall, thought back to the incident earlier. He recollected, "I had heard one of our units responded earlier to an infant cardiac arrest. I kind of filed it away, but later, it just seemed very suspicious to me. Several things that don't happen that often were happening in a very short amount of time. It was more than enough for me to realize that these things were connected, so I called the New Boston Police Department. But someone else had already made the connection and were on their way to Idabel. Doctors at the hospital in Idabel had determined that the woman with the deceased newborn hadn't given birth and that she had no uterus. They had called for detectives, who arrived and identified the woman as 27-year-old Taylor Parker, Reagan's friend who had photographed her engagement and her wedding. Taylor Parker was from Sims, Texas, and was the mother of two children, a daughter born in 2010 and a son born in 2013. After the birth of her second child, she requested a sterilization, but any kind of permanent sterilization had a failure risk, and in 2014, Parker had an ectopic pregnancy. During the surgery for her ectopic pregnancy, it was discovered that she had a benign cyst and scarring from endometriosis. Given the circumstances, the doctor suggested a hysterectomy as the recommended course of action. Seeking guidance, Parker's husband, Tommy Wakasi, turned to the doctor and asked him, what would he do if it were his loved one? The doctor was confident in his recommendation and advised him to proceed with the hysterectomy, which he did. However, when Parker awoke from the procedure, she was upset upon learning that her uterus and one ovary had been removed without her consent. She questioned why Tommy and the doctor hadn't waited for her to wake up to allow her to make that crucial decision herself. As time progressed, Parker's relationship with Tommy began to deteriorate, eventually leading to their separation. It wasn't long until Parker settled down with a new man named Hunter Parker. However, she chose not to disclose her previous hysterectomy with him. It wasn't until they attended a concert in Little Rock, Arkansas, that a sudden illness struck Parker, necessitating a trip to the hospital. It was there that Hunter discovered Parker's partial hysterectomy through medical personnel. In the aftermath, Parker and Hunter engaged in a conversation about starting a family, expressing their desire to have a baby together. Parker assured Hunter that they could hire a surrogate and utilize her inheritance to cover the expenses. According to Parker, she was heir to the Blackburn Syrup fortune. However, in reality, there was no money and Parker was no heir. She had only ever worked office jobs at a staffing agency and a PBGYN clinic. Confident in her plan, Parker informed Hunter that she had arranged for a surrogate and that the necessary funds would be delivered. However, an alleged car accident resulted in the theft of the entrusted money by the EMTs responsible for the incident. Hunter finally began to catch on that Parker wasn't exactly who she portrayed herself to be. Distraught and disillusioned by the turn of events, he filed for divorce, painting Parker as a pathological liar. He claimed that whenever he confronted her about her lies, she would respond with anger and further entangle herself in a web of deceit. Hunter wasn't the only victim of Parker's fabrications. Mackenzie Bright, a close friend of Parker, found herself entangled in a web of false stories. Parker confided in Mackenzie, claiming to have miscarried twins, which left Mackenzie devastated on behalf of her friend. Additionally, Parker deceived Mackenzie by insisting that her hysterectomy was necessary due to stage 4 cancer, claiming, "She told me she was eaten up with cancer." During the period when Parker was still with Hunter and discussions of using a surrogate arose, she approached Mackenzie, proposing that she serve as her surrogate after giving birth to her own daughter. Parker enticed Mackenzie with the promise of a $100,000 payment, which she alleged had been inherited from her grandfather. After a relationship with Hunter came to an end, Parker settled down once more with a man named Wade Griffin. Once more, Parker weaved a web of lies from the beginning of the relationship, telling Wade that she was a millionaire who couldn't get a hold of her money because her mother was plotting against her and preventing her from accessing her fortune. Over time, these elaborate stories began to fall apart when no money ever materialized. Barker shared her fears with her friend Angela Pate that Wade was going to end up leaving her. She recollected, she was obsessed with Wade, and you could tell he didn't feel the same way. She was trying to buy him. When she was with him, she would totally glow and light up the whole room. He was everything to her. She would do anything for him. Parker's tales of wealth and familial assets weren't exclusive to Wade. She spun the same yarn of inherited affluence to Angela. She painted a picture of an opulent lineage, boasting vast land ownership, lucrative gas and oil leases, and substantial royalty earnings. Parker had told both Wade and Angela that her mother was angry that the money was going to her, and claimed that she had even put out a hit on her with the Mexican mafia. Despite catching Parker in numerous lies, Wade contemplated leaving her, but remained ensnared by the fear that her life was truly in danger. To lend credibility to her fabrications, Parker often sought refuge at Angela's residence, insisting that undercover officers were surveilling her every move. To further bolster her deceit, she purchased multiple cell phones, crafted fake text messages purportedly from law enforcement agencies involved in the investigation. Barker even went as far as sending messages from fictitious family members, a lawyer, and an oil company representative. Angela recalled, "You never doubted her. She had answers for everything." However, the convoluted saga took yet another turn when Parker claimed that her mother had been arrested and taken her own life while in jail. Parker confided in Angela that she chose not to disclose the devastating news to her grandparents, fearing that they would be unable to bear the weight of such a revelation. Yet in another twist, Parker later declared that her mother had resurfaced during a family Christmas gathering, leaving everyone in utter disbelief. Angela recalled, "She said she walked in the front door and everyone was shocked her mother was alive because everyone thought she was dead." Sometime later, Angela received an email that was purported to be from Parker's mother, but it read like a villain soliloquy trope. It read in part, "Let her feel in life. Let her see what it's like to have nothing. I've worked it out perfectly. I've arranged this all so there are cracks, you see. Things won't add up and she will look even more like a liar. I stole numbers to make her think people were calling and doing things for her and it was never them. This will not end well for her. No matter where she turns or what she says, there will be a lie to fall back on her. See, I'm going to send her in such deep of a depression that she will probably try to kill herself like she's done before. But if not, then making Wade leave will do the trick. See, he will have no choice but leave because nothing will be true. I've made his family turn on them from pretending to be people like a dealership that didn't get paid. Does it click now to you people? Just let her fall into your hole and not get out." The email, however, was simply from Parker. Parker's tales only continued to unfold, unveiling a pattern of manipulation and deceit that entangled the lives of those around her. Parker then embarked on yet another intricate web of deception. In December of 2019, she reached out to Rusty Lowe, a farm and real estate broker at Century 21 in Paris, Texas, and said that she wanted to purchase Pecan Point, a sprawling 1,500-acre pecan plantation and ranch. Putting forth an offer of $3.5 million, Parker asserted that she and Wade had the funds readily available from an inheritance bestowed by her grandparents. Displaying a sense of urgency, Parker demonstrated her seriousness and pressed for an immediate visit to the property. Rusty reflected on their initial encounter and stated, "My first impression was that they were in a little bit of a hurry. Everything had a sense of urgency. Everything was now, now, now." Despite arriving in a battered vehicle that didn't align with her tales of opulence, Parker and Wade were given a tour of the property, and they instantly fell in love with it. Rusty was seeking a $200,000 earnest money deposit for the purchase, and he soon encountered complications. Initially, Parker claimed that the funds would be sourced from her inheritance, only to later assert that an oil lease would cover the costs. On the 2nd of January, she texted Rusty, indicating a delay in the expected money transfer. 10 days later, she claimed to have switched banks due to frustrations with the previous institution. Over the next several months, the situation unraveled, as Parker failed to produce a plausible explanation for the intended purchase. Desperately grasping at straws, she introduced a mysterious figure called Uncle Butch to Rusty, urging him to trust that she was indeed financially sound, with the funds coming from her enigmatic relative. At this juncture, Parker expressed interest in acquiring two additional properties, totaling approximately $20 million through Rusty. She presented him with emails and letters supposedly validating her status as a multimillionaire, including correspondence from somebody named Shelley Lynx, who was allegedly affiliated with Shell Western Global, and she served as Parker's representative. Allegedly, these documents substantiated Parker's vast wealth, totaling a staggering $370 million. However, when Rusty attempted to establish contact with Shelley, his efforts proved fruitless. That was because Shelley, much like Uncle Butch and every other single person named in correspondence, didn't exist. Parker had made every single person up. Upon learning of Rusty's attempts to verify the authenticity of Shelley and other individuals mentioned in the correspondence, Parker flew into a rage. In a text message, she vehemently declared, "After talking to my dad and attorney, who have brought land for more than this, it was stated to me that the seller can ask, but you don't have to ask them to verify what we have in the bank. Wade and myself both weren't okay with him calling for all that. My Uncle Butch is a multi-million dollar landowner, and he says he has been asked and been denied." Then in March of 2020, Parker issued two checks made out to the closing company, assuring Rusty of her intent. However, on the very same day, she contacted him, asserting the banks preferred wire transfers over checks. Ultimately, in April of 2020, Parker abruptly notified Rusty of their withdrawal from the property deal, attributing the entire scheme to an elaborate plot orchestrated by her mother. She alleged that her mother had deceived her, and the promised inheritance was nothing but a fabrication. Simultaneously, while this intricate charade unfolded, another deception had been taking place. In the early months of 2020, Parker dropped a bombshell on Wade by revealing that she was pregnant. Wade was taken back by the news and recollected. "She told me, and I was kind of shocked because it came at the same time when I'd been telling her that we were not financially in a good place. It seemed like a trap to me." However, the truth was far from what Wade had perceived. Parker wasn't pregnant, nor could she conceive. She had meticulously constructed an elaborate hoax, complete with a fake baby bump she had purchased online and a fabricated pregnancy journey that she documented on Facebook. On the 25th of August, she shared a photo on social media, tenderly cradling her belly while posing next to a horse. Determined to make her deceit appear genuine, Parker invested hours of research into faking a pregnancy convincingly, scouring the internet for tips and even watching YouTube videos on baby care. While a few select individuals in Parker's life were aware of her hysterectomy, she had even lied about that, concocting a false story for her co-worker at Express Employment, Michaela Curtis. Parker claimed she needed the procedure due to cancer discovered during the birth of a stillborn child, framing her purported pregnancy as a miraculous medical anomaly that would be studied by doctors. One afternoon, Parker arrived at work with an ultrasound, claiming it showed a gestation of 6 weeks. However, Michaela examined the ultrasound and noticed that there were twin fetuses that appeared to be 11 and 12 weeks old. On the 23rd of August 2020, Parker conducted an online search for how to adopt a newborn baby. Mom Podcast Food Play. Thanks to Babbel, I know what that means. Do you? Lately, I've been immersing myself in learning French with Babbel, and you can too. In just 3 weeks, Babbel allows you to start speaking a new language. While the best way to learn a language is through immersion, living in a native-speaking country, that option isn't feasible for everyone. Luckily, Babbel provides the next best alternative. In just 3 weeks, you can learn a new language with Babbel. As an avid traveller, Babbel has been incredibly useful for me, and this summer you can also embark on a language learning journey with them. Rather than spending a fortune on private tutors, or relying on dodgy translation apps, Babbel offers quick 10-minute sessions developed by more than 150 language experts. The app's courses are incredibly convenient and have greatly aided me during my travels. Whether it's ordering food at restaurants, booking taxis, or even engaging in conversations with the locals. Here's a special, limited-time offer for Morbidology listeners to get you started right now. Get 55% off your Babbel subscription, but only for my listeners at babbel.com/morbidology. Get 55% off at babbel.com/morbidology. That is spelled babbel.com/morbidology. Rules and restrictions may apply. Following her pregnancy announcement, her ex-husband Tommy anonymously reached out to Wade on September 11th, warning him about Parker's inability to conceive. Tommy didn't want Parker to discover his involvement and penned the anonymous message. It's funny how Taylor is pregnant, but every hospital within a 60-mile radius is watching for her because they're scared she's going to come in and steal a baby, because there's no way she's pregnant. And they all know that because they all got the hospital records. A couple of days later, Tommy contacted Wade again, writing, "I'm reaching out to you because I feel it's the ethical thing to do. In 2015, Taylor got a hysterectomy. She isn't pregnant. She can't get pregnant. She's a con artist and is lying to keep you around. I'm sure you haven't been to one doctor appointment with her, for whatever reason." Upon receiving the second message, Wade shared a screenshot of it with Parker. Astonishingly, within just 15 minutes, Parker's online searches took a dramatic turn. Her inquiry shifted from how to adopt a newborn to locations where pregnant women could be found. Simultaneously, she delved into videos depicting cesarean sections, vaginal deliveries, and the examination of placentae. Her plan had changed from secretly adopting a newborn to stealing a newborn. As the purported due date drew closer, Parker informed Wade of a planned induction at Mount Pleasant Hospital. However, on that morning, she placed a bomb threat call to the hospital, subsequently showing Wade a Facebook post regarding the incident. She informed him that they would need to reschedule the induction. Aware of the urgency to carry out her deceit, Parker had settled on stealing her friend Reagan's baby, and on the 7th of October, she searched for her address. It's worth noting that amidst Parker's apparent desire for a baby, she had outstanding child support debts amounting to thousands of dollars owed to the father of her son, who she had given birth to in 2013. As per the final divorce decree, she was obligated to pay $225 per month in child support starting from March of 2018. However, Parker had neglected to make any payments towards her son's support, resulting in accumulated debt of $7,689, including interest. Despite already having two young children, Parker didn't have custody of either of them. Then on the 8th of October 2020, the day before the tragic deaths of Reagan and Braxlyn, Parker made an appearance at the family home. She informed Reagan that she had a gift for her and the baby, but in reality she had ulterior motives to assess the layout of the home. The following day, Parker had supposedly arranged to meet Wade at Idabel Hospital for what she claimed would be a plan-induced labour and delivery. However, she deviated from her intended course of action that morning. First, she watched a video depicting the physical examination of a preterm infant at 35 weeks, coincidentally matching Reagan's gestational age. Subsequently, she viewed another video showcasing an infant's development at the same gestational stage. Parker then drove to Reagan's home. She knocked on the front door and gained entry. Unbeknownst to Reagan, Parker had concealed a sharp scalpel within her purse. Once inside the kitchen, she viciously attacked Reagan, slashing and stabbing her predominantly in the face, head, and neck. In addition, she used a 4-pound jar that was previously gifted to Reagan on her wedding day to bludgeon her. After forcibly extracting Braxlin from Reagan's body using the scalpel, Parker swiftly fled the scene. At the hospital, Parker was arrested and then charged with murder and kidnapping. She appeared in court for an extradition hearing. She waived extradition to Texas and was moved to the Bi-State Detention Center on the Texas-Arkansas state line in Texarkana. She was jailed without bond on capital murder, murder, and kidnapping charges. Meanwhile, tributes for Reagan came flooding in. Her mother Jessica commented, "Our family is our family, the heart and soul of us, and a big piece of that's gone. And we can never get it back. Everybody says you can have memories. Well, you don't want to just have memories. You want to have your baby. And we never got to meet Braxlin. We're in pieces. I'd never wish this on anyone." Reagan's friend Abby said of her, "She was there for every single person. It didn't matter if you knew her a day or if you knew her an hour. You could count on Reagan for anything. She was always cracking jokes and always had something funny to say. She made events fun, even if it wasn't a good time in someone's life." The community offered their unwavering support to Reagan's loved ones, with several fundraisers to help Homer and Kinley, and even donations collected via t-shirt sales and car washes. On the 15th of October, Parker appeared in court where her bond was set at $5 million. She was appointed lawyer Jeff Harrelson to serve as her defense attorney. By this point, Parker had already confessed that the newborn Braxlin was indeed the child she had taken from Reagan's womb. According to Parker, on the morning of the 9th of October, Reagan had contacted her out of concern for Parker's alleged headaches and blackouts. She claimed that Reagan invited her over so that she could rest. Parker recounted her version of events, stating, "I told her I would come over and could lay down for a few hours, and she said we needed to talk." She claimed to have experienced a blackout on the way to Reagan's residence and arrived at the scene. Parker told detectives, "She grabbed me in a caring manner, but it was forceful. That's when she scratched me, and it was like I was going in and out, and she kept hollering at me in a, you need to wake the fuck up way." According to Parker, a physical altercation between her and Reagan ensued in the garage. Parker alleged that Reagan forcefully closed the garage door during the altercation. Parker explained, "I shoved her down in the garage, like pushed her down. I didn't want to be there because I was afraid that something bad was going to happen." Parker claimed that Reagan struck her head on the car and the garage floor during the altercation. However, Parker's account starkly contradicted the evidence discovered at the crime scene. She claimed that after the fight in the garage, they went inside the house where Reagan proceeded to style her hair for work and voiced dissatisfaction with her relationship with Homer. The detective challenged Parker's account, stating, "You got into a fight, made up, she went and fixed her hair, and you murdered her? Is that what happened? There was a 3-year-old girl in that house. The family want answers." According to Parker's narrative, she informed Reagan that she needed to leave to meet Wade at the hospital. Allegedly, when Parker went to retrieve her bag, Reagan grabbed at it, and Parker accidentally scratched her while pushing her onto a table. Parker claimed, "I think she hit something because she was bleeding." She then claimed that Reagan retrieved a knife from the kitchen and attempted to cut her hand. Parker appeared to have gaps in her recollection of subsequent events, but stated to the detectives, she was laying in a pool of blood. She rolled over and specifically said, "Take her, because I feel like I'm dying." She begged me to take her. She kept saying, "Get her out of me, get her out of me." When asked whether she had arrived at Reagan's home with a scalpel, Parker paused for several moments before acknowledging that she carried a scalpel in a medical kit. When questioned about the whereabouts of the scalpel, Parker initially claimed to have left it on the floor. However, the scalpel was discovered embedded in Reagan's neck, and when confronted with this fact, Parker responded, "I laid it on the floor. I'm going with what I remember. I don't remember stabbing her, and I was the only person there." Parker then suggested that Reagan must have fallen onto the scalpel herself. She further claimed that at one point, Reagan had inflicted wounds upon herself and informed Parker that she would be blamed for them. However, this explanation appeared to be a desperate attempt to shift blame away from herself. The nature of the altercation, which supposedly involved pushing, didn't align with the brutal reality of Reagan being found dead on the floor, having endured over 100 slashes and stab wounds, including a sliced throat. Nevertheless, Parker vehemently denied any responsibility for the horrific act, despite being the one in possession of the scalpel and standing there holding Braxlin in her arms. On the 10th of December, a grand jury indicted Parker for capital murder and kidnapping. That meant that if she were convicted, she would be facing life in prison without parole or capital punishment if the state decided to pursue it. Just the following month, District Attorney Jerry Rochelle announced that they certainly were going to be seeking the death penalty against Parker if she were convicted. He cited the horror and brutality of the attack, the months of premeditation and planning, as well as a lack of remorse by Parker. The decision was made after careful consideration among district attorney staff and the surviving family of Reagan and Braxlin. Her defense attorney, Jeff Harrelson, entered pleas of not guilty on her behalf, and District Attorney Kelly Crisp then announced that she was expecting a grand jury to indict Parker for the murder of Braxlin as well as Reagan. The grand jury ultimately did, meaning that Parker was facing capital murder charges for both the murder of Reagan as well as Braxlin. By September of 2022, a jury consisting of 6 men and 6 women with 2 alternatives was selected, and the trial was ready to commence. During opening statements, Prosecutor Kelly Crisp stated, "How did we get here? How did we get this far? She is an actress of the highest order. The lies and fraud go on and on. The layers of fraud are staggering. You're going to have to understand the fraud to understand what happened on October 9. She then continued, "This started months and months ahead of time until it passed the point of no return and ended up in homicide." Prosecutor Crisp said that the crime was unprecedented in the county, but said that overwhelming evidence would show that Reagan had been killed by Parker. Prosecutor Crisp also told the jury that the motivation to steal Braxlin wasn't because Parker necessarily wanted a baby. Instead, it was to keep her from losing her boyfriend. The prosecutor then detailed Parker's premeditation, describing to the jury how she conducted hours of research into pregnancy. She highlighted the fact that all of the videos she watched and all of the research she conducted focused on pregnancies at 35 weeks. Reagan was 35 weeks pregnant when she was killed. Prosecutor Crisp stated, "My opinion is Taylor Parker faked her pregnancy. She planned and carried out the murder of Reagan." Defense attorney Jeff Harrelson challenged the prosecution's theory. He said, "You can see somebody looked them up, but you don't know why. You have a theory." He asked the jury for its full attention and to weigh up all of the evidence. He described the case as a complicated one, both factually and emotionally, before stating, "The law is the lens and filter you must view these facts through. Sometimes it's not black and white, but a shade of grey." On the first day of the trial, the jury heard from Dr. Chris Mason, who detailed Parker's previous pregnancies as well as her hysterectomy. Defense attorney Mac Cobb asked the doctor whether a pregnancy after a sterilization would be something a patient found traumatic, or something that would cause depression or an extreme reaction. Dr. Mason replied that some patients would be upset, but said that since he wasn't a psychiatrist, he couldn't comment any further. Hunter Parker, Parker's former husband, testified next. He testified about the hysterectomy and his surprise when Parker claimed she was pregnant with her new boyfriend. He was asked whether he told anybody that she couldn't bear children, and said he never spoke to Parker's boyfriend, but spoke to his brother about how Parker couldn't be pregnant. Parker's friend, Mackenzie Bride, also testified about the plethora of lies her once friend had told her, telling the jury, "She could make everything so believable. She played on my weakness. She knew I had trouble conceiving and would believe a miscarriage story." Mackenzie's sister-in-law also told the jury that she knew Parker couldn't get pregnant, since she had asked Mackenzie to be her surrogate. She said that when Parker announced her pregnancy in 2020, she knew that she couldn't have been pregnant. She said to the jury, "She was a liar and was manipulating people to think she was pregnant." Parker was known as something of a fantasist whose lies built up over time. There was a handful of people who knew that she was faking her pregnancy. Her defense attorneys tried to question why nobody contacted law enforcement, but the prosecution rebuffed this and said that it isn't illegal to fake a pregnancy and that somebody cannot be arrested on suspicion that they might commit a crime. After several witnesses testified, the prosecution made a point to remind the jury that Parker was not insane and had been deemed competent to stand trial. Their comments had come as Parker's other ex-husband, Tommy Y. Casey, took to the stand and was asked by defense attorney Harrelson whether Parker had ever had a mental evaluation. Prosecutor Crisp stated, "If Miss Parker was incompetent, we wouldn't be in this courtroom. Miss Parker is not insane, or we would not be having this jury trial. So as Miss Parker sits here today, she's found competent." Hunter's mother, Deanna Parker, testified about Parker's state of mind when she was with her son. She said they always caught her out in lies and then she'd cover up those lies with even more lies. However, it wasn't always like this. She said there were days where Parker could be ordinary. They would go shopping, cook meals, and hang out. Prosecutor Crisp asked, "Taylor Parker can be normal when she wants to be normal. If things are going her way, she can make the decision to be normal?" Deanna replied, "Yes." Deanna then turned to the jury and stated, "Taylor is not crazy. She is normal as me and you." Once the trial continued, more witnesses testified about Parker's long con, claiming that she was to inherit millions. Rusty Lowe was one of them, and he said he never believed that Wade was in on the con. Jessica Reagan's mother testified next, telling the jury in excruciating detail how she found her firstborn daughter dead on the living room floor. Through tears, she said, "Her red hair was what stood out, and her hair was blonde." The paramedic who tended to Parker at the side of the road then testified and said that they planned on taking her to the hospital in Titus County, but said that Parker began screaming and said she needed to go to Idabel. That was part of her plan. She had told Wade that she was giving birth in Idabel Hospital, so she needed to be there. The testimony then shifted to Braxlyn. She weighed 7 pounds and was 18.7 inches long. Dr. Heron testified that she would have been viable at that age and size. There had been a faint pulse on Braxlyn when Parker was pulled over, indicating that she certainly had been alive. After the prosecution rested, defense attorney Harrelson requested a motion of acquittal based on a lack of evidence to prove a kidnapping charge. He claimed that Braxlyn was never alive. This was rebutted by prosecutor Crisp, who said that Braxlyn had a heartbeat at a time of death. She stated, Taylor meant for her to be born. The defense then opted out of calling any witnesses and closing arguments were presented. The jury deliberated for just 1 hour before returning with a verdict. They found Taylor Parker guilty of the murder of Reagan and the kidnapping of Braxlin. Following the verdict, Homer filed a civil suit against both Parker and Wade. The suit claimed that Parker was negligent for driving recklessly and erratically with baby Braxlin in Wade's car after cutting the baby from Reagan Hancock's body on the morning of her murder, causing the infant's death. The civil suit asserted that the baby's injuries were caused as a result of Parker's negligent, careless, and reckless disregard of her duty to exercise the degree of care that a reasonably careful person would use to avoid harm to others under circumstances like those described herein. That included failing to keep a proper lookout for the baby's safety, failure to stay in the proper lane, control her speed, and control her vehicle. The suit also claimed that Wade was negligent for allowing Parker to use his vehicle because he knew her to be a liar and unstable. The sentencing phase came on the 12th of October, and prosecutors asked the jury to sentence Parker to death, while the defense sought leniency by arguing that Parker was mentally ill. Victim impact statements were presented, including one from Jessica, who directed it at Parker, telling her, "My baby was alive, still fighting for her babies when you tore her open and ripped her baby from her stomach." She said that the past 2 years had been a never-ending nightmare and said that the worst part was watching Kinley grow up without a mother. She then said that Reagan's death had been harder on Kinley than anyone. She said that if the little girl sees a pregnant woman, she will sometimes ask if they're hurt or bleeding. She also said that Kinley doesn't like looking at photographs of her mother in a red shirt because it looks like she's bleeding. She stated, "She's doing okay. Homer is taking very good care of her, but we will never know what's going through her little head. I know what I saw, and I can't imagine." The jury then heard testimony from Dr. Timothy Proctor, a psychologist who evaluated Parker on the 6th and 7th of September. He said that Parker had given him different accounts of Reagan's murder than she had done previously. He testified that Parker told him that she had told Reagan that she wasn't really pregnant, but then became paranoid about what Reagan would do with that information. He stated, "She said Reagan had a painted look on her face and was turning away like she didn't want to help her after all. She asked for help, and Reagan said no. She said Reagan looked at her like an animal before you put it out of your misery." During this confession, Parker said that Reagan had not actually been the intended target and that she had targeted another pregnant woman. He said he diagnosed her with borderline personality disorder, but not a mental illness or mental defect. A defense witness, Dr. Siddhartha Nadkarni, testified about irregularities he found in Parker's brain scans. Under questioning by Assistant District Attorney Lauren Richards, he said he disagreed with testimony about Parker having a severe frontal lobe dysfunction. He testified that a person with a problem this severe would be in a skilled nursing facility with memory issues. The jury deliberated for 90 minutes before handing Taylor Parker a death sentence. The lawsuit that Homer filed is still currently ongoing. The anticipation of welcoming her baby girl, Braxlin, into the world filled Reagan Simmons Hancock with joy and excitement. Little did she know that a sinister fate awaited her, unfolding in a horrifying act committed by someone she considered a friend. In a chilling display of foreshadowing, Reagan had expressed concerns about the possibility of her baby being born prematurely. However, the premature nature that she would ultimately face was far more gruesome than anybody could have ever imagined. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to say the biggest thank you to my newest supporters up on Patreon, Christian and Lola. As I've mentioned a million times before, Morbidology is a one-woman podcast. I research, write, host, and edit the episodes myself, so the support up on Patreon seriously goes such a long way and helps to defray the costs that come with hosting a podcast. If you'd like to check it out, the link to Patreon is in the show notes, and you can join for as little as $1 a month, and there are absolutely no obligations. You can stay for as long or as little as you like. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.